Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Listening to Open Minds Radio. Thank you very much for doing so. By the way, we have a great show today. We have Nick Redfern, and I've never had him on the show actually before, so it's great to have him for the first time. I've met two, and we've never been able to coordinate, and we still don't know 100% if we'll be able to coordinate. I mean, everything's set up. I just talked to him. He's willing. He's ready, but since we're doing it live, you never know what can happen. And that's what we're going to do. We usually, actually very often, we pre-record these shows, but this one's going to be live, so hopefully everything goes okay. We tried to pre-record, but this big storm in Texas, all hell broke loose in Texas right when we wanted to record this spectacular interview with Nick. So, and because of the holidays and the turkeys and everything, we ended up having to do it live, which is going to be exciting. And if for some reason you're not aware of who Nick Redfern is, and some of you may not, he's written quite a few big books on this field. He's written one on contactees, on Men in Black, on Roswell. He does a lot of cryptozoological type of stuff. In fact, he's got a book called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. That sounds quite scary. So we'll be talking a lot about this. I love the contactee subject, and we've talked about the contactees of the 50s, those crazy guys that used to go around and do wild and crazy stuff, talking to aliens. And some of them, you know, allegedly took pictures and videos of UFOs and these aliens. So we're going to ask Nick what he thinks about them. And the reason why I'm particularly interested in what Nick has to say, because he also has kind of a controversial idea about UFOs and their origins in the first place. So we'll talk to Nick about how he got into this crazy, crazy field and how he came to his crazy, crazy ideas. Although I think his ideas are very interesting and possibly right on point. And he happens to have an accent as well because he's from across the pond, as they say. So Harry Potter Land is very popular. So we'll talk more about that coming up here. But before that, we're going to talk about the news. And I did want to mention, of course, the UFO Congress, which is late February. We're going to have a lot of cool speakers. Maybe when Jason, our news correspondent, comes on, we'll talk more about that. And let's just get to him right now. Every day on Open Minds and on our Twitter, and on Remember the UFO Daily News Twitter, we are tweeting and following up on news and UFO headlines from across the world. And every week we bring in the best UFO correspondent that money can buy, and that is Jason McClellan. You pay him and he'll do anything for a buck. And so we gave him a couple bucks, and he comes and does the news for us. So it's great. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Mr. Alejandro, and hello, everyone. This is your Open Minds news brief for Monday, November 28, 2011. A recent article published by Space Daily states, quote, most scientists think that we are not alone in the universe. But as Wired recently explained, most of these scientists are focused on Earth-like planets as the best candidates for finding extraterrestrials. Earth-like planets are extremely rare in comparison to the number of total planets in the universe. And with scientists focusing only on these few planets, the extremely narrow search overlooks so many other worlds that could be home to extraterrestrial civilization. That is why a team of scientists recently proposed a wider set of criteria for planets that could support life. This team of astrobiologists proposed two new planetary rating systems that could help widen the search for extraterrestrial life. Researchers suggest ranking planets on both an extraterrestrial similarity index, an ESI, and a broader planetary Habitability Index, a PHI. Wired explains, quote, the first index looks at how close a planet is to Earth in mass, temperature, and composition, while the second is based on whether or not it possesses more exotic chemistries, liquids, and energy sources than found on our planet. Alien life could be based on elements other than carbon, require liquids other than water, and gain energy through means other than sunlight, end quote. Abel Mendez of the University of Puerto Rico in Arecibo is one of the co-authors of the proposed rating system. He explains, quote, we are trying not to be geocentric, calculating planetary habitability independent of liquid water, end quote. The team's proposed rating system was published in the journal Astrobiology on November 21st. Well, Alejandro, this is something that you and I have been mentioning week after week after week when we talk about the Kepler telescope and all the efforts to search for extraterrestrial life. And, you know, we point out that we're operating, we being the scientists doing this stuff up in space, NASA and the like, are looking for Earth or life as we know it. And that's how big the universe is. Mm-hmm. At least as big as we think it is. There, we have no idea what other life could be out there. Well, we have ideas, but not all life. And we're basing it all off what we know, what life is on Earth. So by looking at all these other worlds out there, there's so many bizarre alien planets.
Mm-hmm.
And we pass them by very quickly if we say, oh, too hot. Well, doesn't have water. But now, thanks to these scientists, they're reevaluating that.
Yeah, I think these guys are coming up with more scenarios. They're widening the scope a little bit. It's neat that they're talking about it and thinking about it. I think that, you know, they're getting somewhat creative as opposed to the small scope, like you said, kind of being unimaginative and looking for our perspective of what life is like here on Earth. But I think, you know, what's funny about this is there's, until we find something and find many different types of life out there, we have absolutely no idea. So no doubt that because it's such a fledgling science, I mean, because we haven't found life yet, at least they haven't in their official capacities, that it'll look a lot different when it's really rolling than it does now.
And perhaps effort should be concentrated more on the bodies closer to Earth where we could actually do something with what we find. I mean, things have been passed over before, the moon, Mars. I mean, we're planets that once were just kind of glanced at are now being reevaluated because we're now finding new things that indicate water. Whereas before, you know, we're just looking for standing surface water.
Yeah, and I still have never explained, I don't know about you, I've never understood why we didn't really go back to the moon so much. I understand going to Mars, which is great. We have the bigger rover going out there. But all of this effort, you know, we had the first space lab, which was, you know, trashed and they let it burn into the atmosphere. And we have the space station, which has had, you know, kind of limited access to scientists. A lot of it's been defense stuff. We could have all of this effort if it was focused at the moon. I mean, we'd be up there mining away. We would be at the poles where they think there might be water. I mean, there could be a lot more to find at the moon, and instead we're passing it up and we're going to Mars. And now other countries, I mean, China's going to be able to have a base on the moon before we are, the way things are looking at right now.
Will.
So
yeah, no,
we could have missed out. China's going to be playing with some moon monkeys. We're going to be with our little rover in Mars.
We've talked about that before, and I'm sure many of our listeners have that same question. It makes absolutely no sense why they can come on the moon. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are plenty of conspiracy theories to go around for everybody with that one. But, it's such a bizarre concept that there it is, the closest body to Earth that we could get to the easiest. It's not that easy to get to the moon, but we can do it. So to just abandon that and then focus on other things that are kind of not achievable with our current technology is kind of bizarre.
Where did the space station get us? I mean, sure, everybody, you can definitely see the benefit in Kepler now and in Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
But really, you know, what amazing discoveries have we had on the space station?
That it's still kind of hanging out.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Piece of space junk hasn't brought it down yet.
I think it would be cool if we had that thing on the moon, Moon Base Alpha.
That'd be pretty cool. I mean, I need to work on it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Bigelow needs to quit camping out. And,
Moon Base Bigelow.
Yeah, needs to get a move on. Well, let's get into another story, Alejandro. Resident of Ripon, I should ask my friends in Wisconsin if it's Ripon or Ripon. I think it's Ripon.
I think it's Ripon.
Ripon, Wisconsin?
Americans probably say it Ripon. The French who established it probably say
Ripon.
Ripon.
Okay, we'll go with Ripon. Residents of Ripon, Wisconsin, saw UFOs in the night sky on November 16th. According to Ripon Press, quote, suddenly everything rumbled, which caused residents to look towards the sky, where they saw strange glowing lights that lit up bright and then faded out in sequence. Ripon Police Chief Dave Lukowski claims he witnessed the event, but that it was military jet. He described, quote, it was a screaming jet going over us. Green Lake County Chief Deputy Mark Putke said there were no reports of UFOs in his jurisdiction that night, and that representatives from the Wisconsin Air National Guard claimed the Guard was flying missions over Ripon at the approximate time of the sightings on November 16th. But a video supposedly of the same event shows hovering lights in the sky, fading out, then turning on again. The objects in the video don't appear to be screaming military jets. So while the military has taken credit for the incident, this video doesn't appear to support their story or the witness accounts.
Yeah. Sounds like an interesting sighting.
And it sounds like a story that we hear frequently with sightings that happen over a populace. We've had many witnesses, and then later, because of the responses, you get the military claiming responsibility or providing an explanation,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't quite fit with what people saw. And in this case, you have a video. It doesn't show screaming military jets zooming by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have a police officer, and well, just like, you know, sometimes they want to just write things off too, just like last week with our guest, we talked about seeing the UFO and the cops came out and said it was a star. So, yeah, unfortunately, people blow these things off a little too quickly sometimes.
And I will point out that certainly, you know, I'm not saying that the police or the military in the case are intentionally lying. You know, there can be multiple incidents on the same night. And, you know, we saw that with lights. There were multiple things in the sky
mm-hmm.
that night. So you have different stories. So just because one person said, I saw this, and somebody else has a video that shows something else, it doesn't mean that person's lying. You didn't see what they're saying.
Yeah. Or like Stephenville, where there were jets in one area, and then there was a sighting in another area. And then through FAA radar reports, the MUFON investigators demonstrated that it appeared that some of those jets broke off from the routines that they were carrying out in another location to kind of go by where the sightings were, presumably to check out what it was that was being reported or caught on radar, and which is what witnesses said. They said they saw the UFO, and they said they saw jets fly by soon after. So, and everything that the witnesses had reported, in this case, jets and the UFO, bore out and were confirmed by the radar reports.
And we also see this a lot with incidents that are claimed to be Chinese lanterns
mm-hmm.
by a second party. You know, the witnesses come forward and tell the behavior of the lights in the sky and things they saw. And then, you know, days later, you'll hear a group come forward and say, oh, that was us. We were having a party. We really shot the lanterns. But, you know, the witness testimonies in these cases, you have descriptions of things changing altitude rapidly and changing shape and size and color and different things that don't exactly match behavior of Chinese lanterns. So.
Yep. It's tough. I mean, I've seen video of something that's round and red flying around in the sky, and it zips around super quick. It was following, people saw it, and it was, when it was close, it was more like a 6 feet tall thing. I have video of this thing. It was getting super bright and super dark, and it fits the description of a Chinese lantern because it's round and red, but it certainly wasn't.
Right.
And so if there is someone floating some Chinese lanterns that light night, oh, that was just me. And they may think that, oh, those people were fooled by my Chinese lantern. Little did they know, or did they witness, you know, this other amazing object flying around.
And lately we're seeing that more and more with the stunt planes too.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like there's more of that, especially Chinese lanterns, there's more of that. I saw them in my town, which was kind of cool, and separate from the ones that we launched. And I don't know about stunt planes. There's a lot of that. There seems to be more of the parachuters with the flares than there used to be.
Right.
And, of course, radio-controlled planes with LEDs and kites with LEDs, the LED technologies.
Yeah, a lot of that.
Yeah.
Well, a little bit of Hollywood news here. Director Ridley Scott's highly anticipated film Prometheus was apparently partially inspired by the writing of Swiss author Eric von Daniken. According to The Hollywood Reporter, Scott explained, NASA and the Vatican agree that it is almost mathematically impossible that we can be where we are today without there being a little help along the way. That's what we're looking at in the film, at some of Eric von Daniken's ideas of how did we humans come about. Von Daniken is known for his books like Chariots of the Gods and Gods from Outer Space, which deliver his ancient astronaut theory, an idea that suggests extraterrestrials were in contact with ancient civilizations on Earth and may perhaps be responsible for starting the first civilizations on Earth. Von Daniken frequently appears on the popular History Channel program Ancient Aliens. And Prometheus was originally planned as a prequel to the Alien movie franchise. Screenplay was reworked, though, and the movie will now reportedly occupy, quote, the same general universe as the Alien movies, but won't be directly related to those films. Prometheus is scheduled for a mid-2012 release.
That's funny, though, because now they're saying the aliens from Alien are going to be in there. So it really, and it happens before, so it's really a prequel, it's turning out to be, even though they said it wasn't, it's kind of morphed. But I'm so excited about it. And it's funny that it's based off of Sitchin, and he pretty much adopted the Ancient Aliens idea, you know. He
Von Daniken.
Or Von Daniken, but what did I say?
Right, Sitchin.
Oh, yeah, Sitchin. Von Daniken, and he, you know, has pretty much come out, Ridley Scott, and said, you know, I believe that there, you know, this is a real thing that happened, this Ancient Alien whole theory, which is kind of cool. And I don't know if you noticed this. If you guys haven't seen the pictures, check out the link on Open Minds TV, and you can go see the pictures because they look really cool. And one of the pictures has this big human-shaped carving, very similar to the picture that the Mexican
the Mayan documentary.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I thought too.
Yeah,
it's funny. A large head carved in stone.
It must have been inspired by it. It definitely was inspired by Olmec or some Mayan type of thing because it's a flat face. But it's this real big carved face. And pretty cool. I'm really excited about this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be huge. There's been so much hype about this and very little information released.
We've
been talking about it since the idea even started.
Yeah, they're being very secretive. When's it supposed to launch, do you know?
Mid-2012.
Okay, so we got some time.
Yeah. Well, the UFO Science and Consciousness Conference was held over the weekend in Johannesburg, South Africa. The conference featured presentations on a variety of ET-related topics from 13 speakers, including, also interesting, Laura Eisenhower, the great-granddaughter of Dwight Eisenhower. She spoke about heart technology being used to thin the Earth's population. And Michael Tellinger, who organized the conference, told attendees that, quote, all the governments in the world are puppets, controlled by extraterrestrials, and that the South African government had been one of the most important puppets to these extraterrestrials because of the country's richness in gold and diamonds. The theory of gold-hunting extraterrestrials isn't new, kind of similar to Well, a lot of people have said this, and there's a lot written about it. And even Stephen Hawking, with his wonderful statements, sort of support this notion that an extraterrestrial would come and take our resources and wipe us out. But evidence, there's evidence that suggests that there is more gold elsewhere in space than on Earth. For example, on the asteroid Eros, there is more aluminum, gold, silver, zinc, and other base and precious metal than have ever been excavated in history, or indeed could ever be excavated from the upper layers of the Earth's crust. That's just on one asteroid, and not a very large one at that. There are thousands of asteroids out there, and that's according to a statement from the BBC in 1999. So with that in mind, we don't have anything on this planet. So
Yeah, to come here for gold is
piddly in comparison to what's out there.
Maybe they would argue that they don't have these hairless monkey animals they can enslave to extract the gold for them on those other barren rocks.
That's true.
But they could shoot them with their lasers and then pick up the gold.
Which is easy when you have an army of people to do things for you.
Yeah. So that could be the possible argument. But interesting that, you know, Africa should have their first conference. It was slated as the first UFO conference.
This was Africa's first, and it was hyped up pretty good.
And they went straight to the fringe type of stuff.
From all the headlines I've seen today, and there were a lot of them, it was definitely pushing out the fringe. So.
But unfortunately, it didn't seem to have the impact that the mega conferences such as the UFO Congress had.
No, I don't think it's close to the UFO Congress.
If you can call it a mega conference. For the UFO world, it is.
The UFO field is definitely a mega conference.
Yeah, definitely. So, but when you're just starting, you know, it'll pick up steam and keep rolling. And
And you know what? Even I'm glad these guys had their conference go off this past weekend. That's great, and I hope it continues. Based on a lot of the stories that we've covered from this year and last year, I would really like to see Australia get theirs off.
Yeah,
they were getting closer, and they were going to get some government funding for it.
Yeah,
and then they lost the funding, and haven't heard any more about that. But a lot of interesting things out of Australia. I think an Australian conference would be really cool.
Yeah, in other countries, a lot of conferences would be cool. England, I think they were going to have one, and then it kind of, I don't think it's happening anymore. The people who do the UFO magazine out there, but. So,
a couple of conferences.
Yeah.
They
have a couple.
Yeah.
So, but I was reading, you know, what Nick Pope wrote about the UFO Congress last year that you posted. I think you tweeted that, or Maureen did, and he had a lot of cool stuff to say, and he was kind of the same, hoping that they could have a conference like the UFO Congress out there. So it'd be cool to have the big conferences, you know, all over the world, which hopefully would help inspire then some more communication.
Right.
You know, I wrote this Chinese ufology story for the upcoming magazine about the recent sightings and stuff. And that's one thing that would be nice is if we could have more contact with the Chinese. Or, you know, we've written about the Russians, more contact to talk back and forth and cover each other's stories and feed each other information and help each other out.
That'd be so great. You're right. I mean, you and I talk about this a lot. There's so many amazing researchers in China that it would be fantastic to have an open dialogue with them.
Our buddy Wang Zichao.
Yep, exactly.
Not that we've gotten to talk to him, but we love him just the same.
We do.
Yeah.
Well, on the topic of conferences, we have another one to talk about here. UFO investigative journalist Paola Harris is producing a conference that will highlight women in ufology. Those involved in the field of ufology have historically been predominantly male, and therefore UFO conferences have had predominantly male attendees. Paola Harris is hoping to change that with her Women's UFO Symposium. As she explained to the Huffington Post, women are not on the forefront of many UFO conferences. It's kind of an old boys club. The Women's UFO Symposium will take place May 19th through 20th, 2012, in Glen Rose, Texas, near the town of Stephenville, the site of the well-publicized UFO sightings in 2008. And while all the speakers at this conference are women, men are certainly welcome to attend.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think that's great that she's going to be doing that, and that she's going to have the daughter of Kenneth Arnold.
That is really
so
cool.
That's
for the
cool.
first time speaking
yeah.
about Kenneth Arnold and
yeah.
and talking about other sightings that he had, not just
yeah.
the one that he's known for.
Yeah, right, that he had other sightings, and she said she's going to write a story of this interview for the magazine,
right?
For our magazine, Open Mind. So that's going to be – that's I think – I love that she's putting together this women's one, too, just to kind of, you know, because they always seem to be the minority in these conferences because there aren't as many researchers. But it's cool to have them highlighted. There's some great women doing some incredible stuff out there. I think that, you know, Betty, who we talked to last week, that's cool. She's written her book, and it's a different perspective, you know, her dealing with her husband as opposed to we hear a lot about husbands dealing with their wives in this field. So it's really cool. I think it can open it up and hopefully make some of the wives of the husbands be more open and hopefully make women feel more comfortable to be involved with this field.
I'm very proud to say that the strong majority of the speakers at this conference have been guests on this radio show.
That's right. And they're our buddies.
That's right.
And they're cool dudes. Or dudes.
And Romanek's wife is going to be one of the speakers, Lisa Romanek.
That's really exciting because I think our radio show is about the only outlet she's had to really speak. Because people don't invite her, they invite Stan. And
right.
That's why I like to have her on the show, because I think her perspective is really interesting because she's a witness, and she's a credible witness. So,
and is her book out yet?
I don't think so. She's written her own book. I think it'll be out by then, but I think it's finished, and it's in the process of being published or however they're doing that.
And I don't have the list in front of me, but it's... I remember Carol Rosen was speaking at that time.
Yep. Carol Rosen, of course, that involved with Stephen Bill will be Angela Joyner.
Angela Joyner, and she's getting a special award
yeah.
at this conference.
So, which is really cool. And, yeah, you're the news guy. You're supposed to have the list.
It's on the video for people watching the video.
Uh-huh.
So when they watch this on YouTube, they can see the list.
Yeah.
But we also have the information on our website, openminds.tv.
Yeah.
But congratulations, Paula. I think this is a wonderful idea, and it's something I will definitely plan to attend, even though I am one of these old boys.
Good old boy?
I'm a good old boy.
No, you're too young to be a good old boy.
That's true.
Oh, Vaughn Smith, who we've had on the show recently.
Yeah.
We've had Carol Rosen. Amy Sparrow, we're good friends with her, but we haven't had her on the show. I didn't know she had stuff to say, so that's awesome. I'm interested to see what she has to say. She's involved, and she helps out in the L.A. area. And then Tracy Austin Peters, who mostly does ghost stuff in
right.
Las Vegas that
right
now. Right. But she used to host, actually, the MUFON Symposium, and she's a really neat lady. In fact, her husband, before he moved to California, because she used to do a TV show out of California, mm-hmm. He was in Colorado. I think he was the state director of MUFON in Colorado for
oh.
a while. Yeah, really cool people. So pretty exciting.
We should have her on the show.
Yeah, we should. I know. I talked to her not too long ago, too, and she mostly does ghost stuff, but I haven't thought about. She's interviewed a lot of people on UFOs, so that would be really interesting.
What's her talk on? Do you have it up there?
No.
I
did.
What she's going to be speaking out of the UFO conference.
And I don't think they have those details yet.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure she's got plenty to say. You're right. She's done quite a lot. So,
mm-hmm.
But I'm also interested in her ghost stuff. But that's cool if they have her. I didn't know that she had been involved with the MUFON.
Yeah, she was a host. I mean, John Greenwald's been the host for a long time, but she was a host in between there. 1 year, and she was great. It was a lot of fun because she has a great accent.
Yeah.
She's, I can't remember if Australian or English, but because unfortunately to us Americans, and I apologize for my Australian and British friends, but we can't always tell the difference. And I am so sorry.
No, we're not good at picking that up.
Yeah.
Well, Alejandro, that is it for the news for today. Remember to check out all these stories and so many more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your Open Minds news correspondent, and you have been briefed. Back to you, Mr. Alejandro.
All right. Thank you, Jason. So all of these stories he just talked about, of course, can be found on the website, openminds.tv, and you can see the pictures and stuff that we talked about. And I think we've covered all the stories that are on there pretty much this time. Sometimes we talk about a couple afterwards. But let's go ahead and try to bring up Mr. Redfern. And what we're going to do is we're going to dial him. So you'll hear some dial music, and then we'll have him come on. And let's do some dialing music. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-da-ba. Ba-do-do-do-do-do-do. We are dialing, la-la-la. Do-do-do-do-do. Ba-ba-da-ba.
Hello?
Okay. Hello? Can you hear
Hello?
Me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks, Alan. How's it going?
Very good. It's great
good.
To have you on. I'm excited to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. So what I wanted to talk about first was sort of your whole how this all started for you.
Alrighty.
I mean, I've never heard a story about how you got interested in the paranormal and how you kind of started this crazy journey.
All right. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, we're good to go. You're on live and we are A1.
All right, cool. Well, basically what happened was that my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and this was during the what was called National Service. National Service is like the English, or was the English equivalent of the draft. In the same way, you know, there's no draft in America now, there's no National Service in England. But back when my dad was sort of 18, 19, he was drafted into the military and he chose to go into the Royal Air Force. He had an interest in aircraft, and even to this day, he actually works as a guide at a Royal Air Force museum in England called RAF Cosford. He sort of gives tours and things like that. So he chose the Royal Air Force and worked on radar. And he, you know, trained in radar, basically. This was the height of the Cold War. And, of course, you know, everybody thought there was going to be some sort of confrontation with the Russians. So, you know, it actually wasn't that sort of like a relaxed, easy draft. You know, everybody was really highly trained because they thought war was coming. And my dad worked, as I said, on radar. And he was involved in three UFO incidents, or rather you could call it one incident that occurred over three nights in September 1952, at the height of a NATO operation called Main Brace. And what happened was that both pilots and the radar in the air and ground-based radar personnel reported seeing these, or tracking these objects on the radar, and the pilots seeing these strange balls of light in the sky. Again, first thought was it was the Russians, so more aircraft were scrambled to try and intercept them. Couldn't get close to them, and eventually the pilots returned to base because they were just literally running out of fuel. As I said, this went over the course of like 72 hours, something like that, and eventually everybody was taken into a room, everybody who was involved, and was told, you know, you won't talk about this. This is sort of national security issues. And my dad didn't tell me till I was like about 13 or 14. And so that sort of got me interested in UFOs, not just because, you know, the story had come from my own dad, but because he was also trained in the military to work on radar and understand, you know, the difference between picking up like a solid object on the radar screens versus, you know, like a shadow return from a cloud or something like that, which can happen on occasion. And when I finished school, you know, I was one of these kids who, I didn't do very well at school. I was pretty much useless at everything, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I went down what in England's called the job centre one day, and I was like 16 or 17, and turned out they had an opening on a music and fashion and entertainment magazine in the town I was living at the time. It was called Zero, the magazine. And I thought, well, you know, this sounds like a cool job. It sounds like the sort of, don't say like a real job, you know, where you got to go to work and wear a suit and tie and be told what to do.
Right.
More relaxed and chilled out and whatever. You know, and I was getting paid to do like gig reviews and record reviews and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, and it was fun. And I thought, well, you know, I've enjoyed sort of getting into the world of writing with not much of an academic background behind me, really. And then I thought, well, why not try now and combine not exclusively, because I'd still do a lot of sort of music stuff and entertainment stuff, you know, as well. I don't just sort of write about paranormal stuff. But what happened was that I thought, well, you know, I've got this sort of two-year background on this magazine in journalism, and I've got this interest in UFOs and paranormal stuff. Why not try and combine the two? And so that's what basically what I did. You know, I held down sort of regular jobs for sort of 5 or 6 years up to when I was sort of mid-20s. And then sort of took the plunge and thought, you know, it's like one of those now or never situations, you know what I mean, where it was kind of like, well, I'll give it a try, and if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, then I'll fall back and go on and writing about, you know, the fire service coming to try and get somebody's cat out of the tree or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right.
And just, you know, just continue on writing, but on whatever subject. So that's sort of what really kicked me off. It was this combination of hearing this story from my dad when I was a kid, and then from there, you know, getting involved in journalism and thinking about combining the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow, an amazing story that your father had there, because like you said, you know, they're on alert back then. They're really freaked out about the Russians.
Yeah, I mean, this is a long time ago. I mean, my dad's 80 next year, but he still talks about this and still remembers it. You know, and he, to his credit, you know, he doesn't speculate or over-speculate on what it was. He just said, you know, we picked up something, and he says, I can tell you for sure, back in 52, there was no way we were flying things that could travel at that speed and perform, you know, almost like left and right-hand turns at, you know, fantastic speeds. He said, and the movements, you know, it was clear these things were under some sort of intelligent controls.
Now, when was it that you moved to the United States?
About 11 years ago, something like that.
Okay.
Although my wife's from Texas, we live just outside Dallas, just like about a 15-minute drive from Dallas, 20-minute drive from Dallas. Although she's was born in Texas, she actually grew up in the Cayman Islands. So we got like a real international relationship, I suppose. We live in Dallas.
Wow.
She grew up in the Cayman Islands. I grew up in England, and we live just outside Dallas. And I've been over lived here, I should say, about 11 years. I first came over about 13 or 14 years ago for a conference, something like that.
Okay. Now, I'm curious because these days, you know, Britain news is full of UFO stories. The Sun, the Daily Mirror, the Daily Telegraph, you know, even the Guardian writes stories. It's a big topic that you see a lot of, you know, and others too, because, you know, we're covering news stories in England all the time. They seem to have almost as many as we have here in the States. So I know it's a big deal now. But what was it like growing up? Were people open to the idea of UFOs, you know, prior to coming out here?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, because there's absolutely no doubt that in terms of the British media, stuff's definitely changed significantly changed in the last 5 or 6 years. But there's been a definite trend probably over the last 9, 10, 11 years. And a lot of it actually coincided with when the government started to release and declassify some of its files, which was showing, you know, that the government did have an interest, that there were credible reports from pilots, military people, etc., and, you know, a substantial number of very good reports from the general public. And I think what happened was that the media began to realize, you know, this wasn't just as they previously perceived it, like a, you know, the typical approach that the media takes all around the world, that if you investigate UFOs, you're kind of weird, you know, and you have no life or whatever, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I think we're all just kind of one step away from a serial killer or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Unfortunately.
But I think what happened was that when the media sort of realized that, well, hang on a minute, you know, the British Ministry of Defense, the Royal Air Force, you know, and friends and colleagues in the US or France and Germany, wherever, were also releasing files, they began to realize that, yeah, when you weave your way through the hoaxes, the misidentifications, et cetera, we're left with a small percentage that are really good reports. And I think, you know, to their credit, at least to a degree, you know, the media did change its approach. And, yeah, they still have this slightly condescending, humorous approach, but equally, they do take the subject far more seriously than they did. And I think given how the situation was sort of 15 years ago and further back than that, you know, any advance has got to be a good advance. And, of course, it brings more publicity for the subject. which hopefully encourages more people to come forward with their accounts, which will, you know, lend more support to the idea that, you know, this phenomena exists.
Right. Yeah, some of the papers I can think of, you know, especially recently, stories in what Wiltshire and Shropshire and Eastbourne are some of the towns where, and some of the smaller local papers where they take these UFO reports very seriously. They don't really make fun of it. They tell it pretty straight. They do interviews with the witnesses, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think you actually get that. I mean, I know that from working in just general journalism, that, you know, there's breaking stories in the town you live in, you know, the little local newspaper wants to cover it, you know, whether it's a murder or a car accident, you know, a truck goes off a bridge, whatever, you know, it's big news because it's at a local level. And I think when it's something that's a mystery as well, you know, somebody sees a UFO or somebody sees Bigfoot or whatever, you know, it's one of these things where the media like to cover it, you know, because it's an entertaining story and it's an interesting story and it's a local one as well, so.
Yeah, curious now that you see that you've seen the two worlds, you know, you've lived here in the States for quite some time, Texas, of all places that you've seen, you know, real Americans and what American life is like. Thinking back when you grew up, because you were, you know, your father telling you these credible UFO stories, you being into the subject, did you bring up the subject with your friends when you were young, and how did they react? Any different than you think Americans would have reacted?
Not really. I mean, it's like even today, you know, if I go back to England and, you know, me and all my mates go down the pub and watch the football, you know, the sort of the soccer, as it's called over here, you know, on the big screen.
Right.
You know, it's not like we're all sort of talking about UFOs or Area 51, you know. It's kind of like I have a deep passion for UFOs and I write about it. But I also like to have a life away from it, you know, and most of my friends aren't interested in it, but that doesn't bother me because we have a lot of other interests that we share anyway, you know, and it's cool to just hang out with a beer and talk about who's going to win, you know, the cup this year in the football or whatever, or, you know, what everybody's been doing and who's got married or, you know, who's done this or whatever, you know. So for me, it's never been an issue or, you know, some sort of dark secret that I don't discuss with people. You know, if people are into it, that's cool. If they're not, you know, I've got plenty of other things that interest me to talk about as well, you know. So, I've been, as I said, I've been into it since as a kid. You know, most of my friends know that. But, you know, some of them are interested. Some of them like to know what I'm up to. You know, others are interested because they know me as a friend, but they're not necessarily interested as such in the phenomena, you know. It's and that's cool, you know. It doesn't have any bearing on friendships. It's just, you know, somebody likes listening to rock music, somebody likes reggae, you know, whatever. You know, it's it could be boring if we're all into the same stuff, I guess. So.
Oh yeah, that'd be real boring. But and luckily you're into the football and rock and roll, so you can cover it all.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about your perspective on the phenomena, because you have some unique perspectives, and I think that you like to, which I think is a good thing personally, because I've talked about all of the other possibilities, and I feel similar, but you are certainly like to look in all the possibilities out there. I would like to get your perspective on the, what is labeled, because we always need acronyms, ETH or the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but about some of your other ideas. What do you think about the ETH these days?
Well, you know, I mean, I think like most people, when you get into the UFO subject, I think a lot of people get into it when you are a kid, you know, like a young teenager, whatever. And it's either often because you've had a sighting, which I've never had, you know, or you have a friend or a colleague or whatever who has, like I did with my dad, and you get into it that way. Or, you know, you just happen to pick up a book and it fascinates you. There's different ways. But I think when you're kind of that age, a lot of things in life are just black and white, you know, and it's only when you get older your sort of perceptions, I wouldn't say change, but you become more sort of worldly, you know, and know what's going on, et cetera. And so, you know, in that respect, I think when I first got it, well, I know, when I first got into the subject, you know, for me it was all UFOs and nuts and bolts, craft, you know, coming from this star system or that star system. Now, I don't dispute that could be the case. But I would probably say at least sort of round about my late 20s onwards, I kind of began to change the views I had. Not as so, some people think, you know, I don't believe in a genuinely unknown UFO phenomenon or unexplained, which is, you know, it's complete garbage. I do. You know, I'm just not sure it's literally extraterrestrial in the sense we understand it. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. When you dig more and more into the complexities of the UFO subject, one of the things I've found is that you find crossovers between certain aspects of the UFO subject and other areas of what people might term paranormal stuff, supernatural issues, where you find kind of parallels between alien abduction stories and accounts that, you know, 500 years ago people would place into the realm of encounters with goblins and things like this, you know, or demons, you know, where it seems like the event is kind of similar. The person's paralyzed in bed. There's this sort of force watching them, etc., you know, and they experience missing time. You know, you have all these archetypal aspects to it. So what I would say is that there's absolutely no doubt in my mind today, as before, that there's a genuine UFO phenomenon of unknown origins that is nothing to do with us as the human race. But whether it's literally extraterrestrial, you know, aliens in metal craft coming from point A to point B, or if it could be like interdimensional or extra-dimensional, you know, things like quantum physics are allowing today for the existence of extra dimensions, I think we're dealing personally with something that manifests and interacts with us from like a far closer point to home than we actually suspect. And I actually sometimes think it could masquerade as extraterrestrial to kind of camouflage its real origins. Now, you know, exactly what that means, what it is, you know, that's the big question. You know, I always say to people, even though UFOs exist, you know, sort of 64 years after Kenneth Arnold coined the term flying saucers, you know, it's the U in UFO still stands unidentified. You know, the idea it means alien spacecraft is a theory or a belief system. You know, so in my mind, there's no doubt that there's a UFO phenomenon from somewhere else, but it's the nature of that somewhere else I'm not entirely sure of. You know, I mean, I've investigated cases, for example, UFO encounters where someone's had like an abduction experience, and then a couple of days later in the house, they've experienced like violent poltergeist activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's difficult to sort of reconcile that with like just the equivalent of, you know, NASA's Apollo astronauts coming here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To me, there's something else going on. You know, and I have a big interest in, for example, research that's been done into like how psychedelics can kind of open, you know, portals or doorways to other realms. Things like mushrooms, DMT, that sort of thing, where, you know, you're altering perceptions, and it seems to open a portal where we can interact with entities that, you know, some people would say, well, you know, you're just tripping, and, you know, it's just your mind distorted and, you know, conjuring up imagery. But a lot of this imagery is almost like archetypal abduction type experiences. Now, the skeptics would say, well, that means abductions are all in the mind. I don't think that. I think altered states can actually open doorways to allow us to interact with these entities. And I think that's why thousands of years ago, you know, the equivalents of abductees and contactees back then were like shaman. You know, people would go up into the mountains and meditate, and they'd encounter or interact with these higher entities. You know, it wasn't just that they were tripping. It actually was that they had found the secrets as to how to interact with these higher entities that, for the most part, with most people today, you know, interact randomly with them, but they could actually provoke the experience.
Right. That's what I like about investigators and some of the you know, nouveau more investigators. I mean, you work with a group of people, Greg Bishop, and you worked with Mac Toney, who unfortunately has passed away, who had similar perspectives. But it's also an openness. I think, you know, a lot of people, it's an area that makes it difficult for science, because I agree with you, there's all this bleed over. There are these experiences people have that are that are internal, their mental experiences. And then some of these experiences seem very similar to paranormal experiences. And but they do, like you said, I agree, there's a phenomena that is external to a person and internal, and they're more similar than I think we'd like to go. And I think people don't want to go there because it grays the water, and then you can't have this, you know, strictly extraterrestrial investigation. And they think science is going to shy away from that. And I can see it being difficult for scientists to play in that area. But if that's what's going on, that's what's going on. And it's just so extremely enigmatic and complicated.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, one of the things I would say, and, you know, this isn't meant as a criticism of the UFO field. It's meant as what I see as an accurate observation. I think there are a lot of people within ufology and key players in ufology, consciously or not, who, yes, they believe that it's extraterrestrial, but equally they take the view that, you know, from a cynical perspective, the ETH and saying what people want to hear sells books, it gets people in at conferences. You know, I don't say what I think people want to hear. I say what I think's going on. I put the information out for people to see. If they think I'm full of whatever, that's fine. Mm-hmm. If they gravitate towards it, that's fine. You know, but I'm not going to say, you know, what I think people want to hear because, oh, that's going to sell me another 5,000 books. You know, that's
right.
Not what I do. Now, I'm not saying most people do that consciously. I don't think they do. But there is a percentage where, for a lot of people, ufology becomes like a belief system. You know, it's aliens from Zeta Reticuli, and they're coming here because their race is dying and they need our DNA. You know, and UFOs have been back engineered at Area 51. That's kind of the scenario that we're almost led to accept as being true,
mm-hmm.
rather than being led to understand that it's just a theory. And so that's why, you know, to me, it would be dishonest of me to lock away in a filing cabinet all the stories I've got where, you know, things like somebody has poltergeist activity after seeing a UFO, or somebody else trips on DMT and they have a classic abduction experience. You know, if it's part of the phenomenon, just because it doesn't sit well in, you know, what this person writes or that person writes, doesn't mean we should hide it, you know, in a cabinet because we want to kiss that person's ass because we want to get on at their conference next year. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
No, that's a terrible wrong approach. You know,
mm-hmm.
if a conference organizer says to me, what do you think about abductions? And I say, well, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say, I think it's this or that because I want to speak at their conference. I'm going to say, I think it's connected with this and that. And if you don't agree with it, you don't want me to speak. That's cool. You know, it's your conference.
Yeah.
You know,
right. One of the feelings I have, and one of the issues I have with being able to adopt one of these ideas and stick to it is that there's a lot of people saying a lot of different things. There's so many people, and they all seem great, incredible, and I don't believe all these people to be charlatans,
mm-hmm.
supposedly talking to Zeta Reticulans, but they don't all have the same story. There's people talking to reptilians or have stories about reptilians, but they don't all have the same story. And there are all these people sure that their story is the only story, but they all can't be right. And somehow there are a lot, you know, these conferences that you talk will have several of these people, but they're not all saying the same thing. They're conflicting, and the people going in attendance will sometimes believe all of them. But how can you if the stories aren't the same? Which leads to, like you said, something more complicated.
Well, yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I actually encourage, you know, I mean, I would love it if somebody put on a conference where, let's say hypothetically an abduction conference, and
mm-hmm.
you had somebody talking about, you know, the whole issue of alien abductions, you had somebody talking about alien implants, but also you had somebody talking about the idea of things like sleep paralysis, somebody else talking about how, you know, something like a psychedelic could open a portal to another realm where these entities can interact with us. I actually really do believe that happens. It would
mm-hmm.
be great if that could happen, but I just don't see the mainstream conferences going down that really alternative path because, as you pointed out before, you know, it's in much of an uphill battle already, particularly if you want to get scientists involved, without suggesting, you know, undergoing some sort of DMT-related, you know, altered state. You know, most scientists are going to shy away from it. And I think most ufologists shy away from it because I think a lot of them want to be accepted by mainstream science. You know, I kind of view my position as not an upholder of belief systems or theories, but someone who's just looking for answers. And that's precisely why sometimes my views on different things have changed over the years. You know, I mean, I've spoken to some UFO researchers I won't name them, it's not my place to name them, but who clearly feel uncomfortable if they have to admit that 10 years down the line, their views on some sort of change. It's almost like they view it as they failed if their views have changed. Well, no, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like if you're 13, you know, and you can't talk to girls, and suddenly at 17 you can, you know, people change, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's that sort of thing. And, you know, if somebody believes that case number one or case number two involved, you know, a secret aircraft in 1997, but by 2007 they believed it involved a UFO, and then in 2012 they swing back to the whatever, to me that's not a problem because we're dealing with an unknown phenomenon. And so the onus and the responsibility is on us to present new data as and when we find it. And if it changes our initial perceptions, well, to me, that we're being honest in saying, well, hey, you know, yeah, this is what I thought, but there's more data now that's pushing it down this path. That's one of the things I never really understand about ufology, why this person is like, oh, he's the guy who believes aliens crashed at Roswell. He's the guy who thinks a Mogul balloon crashed at Roswell. She's the abduction researcher. That person's the cattle mutilation person who thinks it's government experiments. That's the person who thinks cattle mutilations are done by aliens. This is the person who thinks it's the time travelers are coming, not aliens. This is the person who thinks it's reptilians. I don't understand why a lot of researchers end up pigeonholed, why it can't just be the case that you investigate the phenomenon and you go where it goes. And if your views change, we'll put the information out there explaining why, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all good.
And it's science. I mean, there are a lot of scientists who they're sure this theory is probably what it is. But if they're
scientists have always done that, and they're always shown to be wrong, you know.
Exactly. And a good scientist is open to that. We'll say, well, I was wrong, you know. It turned out I was looking this way, but it went that way. And, you know, I used to think that this was the case, but due to our experiments, we found out that that's not the case, that this is the case, you know. Because things change. We find out more information, and you've got to go with the data.
Oh, well, I can tell you exactly why that is. A lot of them fear reputations. You know, it's like, well, with scientists, it's not just reputation. It's also getting government grants, university grants, where they're fearful of losing that. But within ufology, I think it's mainly a fear of reputation. It's like if you change your view, change your mind, oh, you've lost your reputation. Well, my view, you don't lose your reputation, but To be, I don't care about reputations, you know. People say, well, what about your reputation? Well, I say, oh, I ain't got one. You know, I do what I do, you know what I mean? I say what I say. I don't care about digging a hole and falling into it, you know. It's like, it's not even on, you know, it's on the radar. I don't feel like I have to apologize or whatever about having this view or that view or this reputation or whatever, you know. It's just what I do. So.
Right. And I know you're, like you said, you're very open to other people having their point of views and working at things from their area. And because I agree with you 100% that I try to have a variety of people on the show. And it's great. I want to hear people's ideas and what they think. I don't care if they don't agree.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a good example. You know, when you just said about me being open to other people's views, I mean, you know, I wrote a book a few years ago, actually, 7 years ago now, about Roswell, with the possibility of it being some sort of dark military experiment. Now, on the other hand, you have Kevin Randall, who sort of, you know, who thinks there's a very strong probability, I think, that aliens crashed at Roswell. But, you know, me and Kevin are friends, you know, and we don't let that stand between us. You know,
right.
Last time I saw Kevin was at the MUFON conference last year. You know, and we hung out for the weekend, just our booths, our tables were next to each other, we just hung out having a laugh, you know, but we have, I would say, fairly significantly different views on Roswell. So, but, you know, I don't feel intimidated or I have to try and change Kevin's point of view. You know, my view is we're both looking for the truth about Roswell. It's a fascinating mm-hmm. case where clearly the government's, you know, the government's stance or its explanations just don't hold water, or in terms of balloon, don't hold hot air, so to speak.
Right.
And so we're both looking for answers, but, you know, I don't feel the need to be defensive or, you know, oh, well, you're wrong and I'm right. No, you know, we're both looking for answers and you should be able to do that and work well together, even if you don't necessarily agree on anything. But unfortunately, within ufology, you don't often get that. You know, people get hostile if you're against what they believe. And I never really got that. You know, it's like we're dealing with a mystery. If we're dealing with a mystery, well, you know, be open to the fact that it's a mystery. You know, it's not something that you've solved and everybody else is wrong. It's a mystery. Mm-hmm. So let's treat it as a mystery, but let's work together. And if it falls in this camp or it falls in that camp, one of you is going to be right, one of you is going to be wrong. But if you're right or wrong, have the balls to admit to say, hey, I got it wrong, but they got it right. But the most important thing is we solved it. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I hope that that continues in the future, that people become more open. Because I know, speaking of Roswell, you know, and I don't like to bring out names either. It used to be that the Roswell, different Roswell guys, you couldn't get them in a room together. Refused to talk to each other. They didn't like each other.
Yeah.
But these days, you can do that now. And even though they disagree with each other, they can all be in the same room. They can and talking and friends. And now they have a shared history because they've been through all of this different stuff. You know, they've maybe even been battling each other. But more than that, also these other government theories that come forward that everybody agrees is ridiculous or not in some cases.
Yeah.
And they've been to several conferences with each other, and now they see each other on a regular basis. I like to think that, and I hope that people are starting to get along better.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that does happen. You know, I don't want to sort of, you know, sort of say, paint it black and white, because it certainly is. You know, again, I think what would be great if somebody put on a Roswell-themed conference where, you know, they had somebody talking about what the military might have been doing at White Sands in New Mexico, somebody else talking about the definitive alien angle, somebody else maybe, you know, it'd be great if you have somebody there from the Air Force even talking about the crash test dummies, you know. And there afterwards have a round table discussion Q&A where the audience can ask questions, and it's all out in the open. You know, I think that would be great, you know. And I don't understand why there's this sort of hostility of, oh, we don't want that person there because he believes weird stuff, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Here's a question for you, kind of to put you on the spot.
Alrighty.
Then the recent petition that went to the White House about, it was very pointedly, of course, extraterrestrial based.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't mind, you know, being extraterrestrial based, because, you know, this was a petition that, you know, was put together, you know, and fair, you know, and let's give, you know, kudos to the person who put it, you know, the people who put it together, because they're actually doing something. They're getting, you know, off the couch or whatever and making a move. I don't have any problem with that. The only problem I have with things like petitions and petitioning for disclosure and stuff like that is that I always think it's a little bit naive to believe that just because thousands or hundreds of thousands even people demand something, that people in government are actually going to listen and act upon it. You know, maybe that makes me cynical, and it probably does to a degree, but it's kind of like, you know, if aliens did crash at Roswell, and despite what some people have said, you know, I don't rule that out at all. You know, I think if it wasn't a dark and dubious military experiment, it was something definitively non-human, you know, again, whether extraterrestrial, interdimensional or something. You know, I don't give any leeway for like weather balloons and crash test dummies and mogul balloons. So in that respect, you know, if the government's deepest and darkest secret about UFOs is that, yes, aliens really crashed at Roswell, and for whatever reason they don't want to tell us, you know, if that is the truth, and it could be, even if 1 million people petition the government, no disrespect to the people who planned the petition, but if, mm-hmm. if they've got that secret buried so deep for a specific reason, why on earth would they release that information just because somebody sends in a petition?
Right.
You know, to me, again, I don't want to take away the importance of what people are doing or the fact that they're actually motivated to do it. That is all important stuff. Without motivation in the subject, it will stagnate and get stale. So we need that. But on the other hand, we need to look at the history of government, all governments, you know, throughout history. You know, they want to get elected. They want to get the person's vote. But when they're in, you know, it's like, do what I say. You know, and I think the issue of actually respond, you know, actually releasing the truth about Roswell because 100,000 people want to know, you know, I'd probably drop down in a dead faint if the government said, oh, we're going to release the truth about Roswell because 50,000 people asked us to. That's not going to happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, is not going to happen. You know, that's like somebody saying, I'm never going to work because I'm going to buy the lottery ticket every week and one day I'm going to win it. No, I am. You know.
Exactly. So, and so your point of view is, and I agree with you, it's a great effort. It gets public interested, and there are a lot of people who, you know, that's what they want to see exactly the way it happen. But would it be fair to say, in your point of view, no matter how well written it was, even if it wasn't based on extraterrestrials and it was based on, you know, some more really heavy, hard nuts and bolts UFO cases, that no matter how well it's worded, no petition coming from the public is going to have an effect?
No, I don't think it will. And, of course, the other problem is that you know, who do you send who are you sending petition to? You send it, you know, to the presidential office, basically, which, you know, they're in, if they're really lucky, they're in for two terms. You know, they may just be in for one term. Bear in mind, you know, that the president, you know, isn't sort of a fountain of knowledge on everything. You know, they rely on information provided by their advisors. Some of these people, you know, whether they're in the CIA, the NSA, you know, Air Force intelligence, they're there for years. You know, you might have a president who's in power for 4 years. So in other words, you're sending it to the White House, and by default, the president, who gets his information from advisors. In other words, the real keepers of the secrets are not the public face. The public face is the president. Mm-hmm. The real sort of movers and shakers and the string pullers are the people behind the scenes. And you know, it's kind of like we know throughout history, certainly from the Cold War era onwards, that things have gone on in the intelligence communities that the elected officials know nothing about. So, you know, again, there's this sort of naivety, as I see it, that, well, if anybody's going to know, the White House has got to know. You know, ironically, the White House hasn't necessarily got to know what happened at Roswell.
Yeah.
You know, it could well be that the secret is so deeply buried and held. In fact, that's what I actually believe. Whatever happened, I think the secret is actually not known far and wide within the government. I think that the very fact that it's kept secret is because the number of people who know is actually probably incredibly small.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually choose who to bring into the fold, if you like, and who not to bring in. And at times, you know, that may include not bringing in presidents. You know, if the secret's if they've confidently got that secret buried so deep that no one can penetrate it, they may the last word on who they let in on the truth, you know. So.
Yeah, these guys who wrote these reports for the Air Force, I don't believe necessarily they were just, you know, secret keepers or trying to do a hatchet job. They could have genuinely thought they were doing a good job investigating this. I just don't think they even have access to the information.
Well, I'm actually glad you said that, because that is my personal opinion. And there aren't many people who take that view. You know, on the one hand, you have the skeptics who champion it and say, oh, yeah, finally, the Air Force solved it. On the other hand, you have a lot of pro Roswell researchers and people who say, oh, this is just an evil government report, you know.
Right.
I actually agree with you. That is my personal stance, is that, you know, I think what happened is that the Air Force had been forced for years to deal with Roswell, took the view that probably something strange did happen, but were baffled by the fact that they'd made sort of a cursory study of their files and couldn't find anything at all. And they were getting more and more people knocking on the door, and they were like, well, enough's enough. You know, we got to make a full effort to find stuff. They went looking and actually couldn't find anything at all. You know, contrary to what a lot of people believe, you know, all this stuff about Mogul balloons and crash test dummies, these were theories on the part of the Air Force. They actually didn't. They found files on the crash test dummies and files on Mogul balloons, but nothing that actually tied Mogul balloons and crash test dummies to Roswell. So, in other words, I actually believe that if this had been a hatchet job or a cover-up, they would have done a better job of actually proving their point. They would have come up with something that, hey, you know, this proves it. But by their own admission, they say, well, you know, we've looked, we haven't found anything, but we think this is what it is. To me, that does sound more like a best attempt to solve it rather than some evil bunch of guys trying to hide it. And I think the irony is, you know, 64 years after Roswell happened, the evidence, the bodies, the craft, whatever they were sort of shuttled out of Roswell at high speed to somewhere, you know, whether they're still in the same place or there's like a new sort of fortified underground location for them, I don't know. But I think whoever has access to that material, you know, may ironically not include the people, and probably didn't include the people who wrote the Roswell reports, you know.
Right.
We often, I think we sometimes give governments too much credit, you know, the idea that you join the CIA and you're suddenly told about what happened at Roswell and who killed Kennedy. You know, it didn't work like that. You know, if you join the CIA and you're fluent in Chinese, they're going to put you on analyzing, you know, listening on Chinese coded messages.
Here's what
or whatever.
We have to take out JFK and here's how we did it.
Yeah, that doesn't happen. You know, that's just bizarre. You know, it just doesn't happen. And I think, you know, people should look more at how government works and how information is withheld, even from government agencies. And I think I think that applies to the Roswell report. I don't hold the Air Force at fault at all with those reports. I think they did their best effort when faced with a realization that, wow, we've not found anything, but clearly something did happen that wasn't a weather balloon. So.
Yeah. I think, you know, to your point earlier about the president, you know, even Clinton, regarding the same issue, UFOs said, you know, he looked into it, they did reports, but he said they could have lied to me. I don't think I would be the first president that career bureaucrats had kept information from.
No, and I think, you know, sometimes I think, you know, it may not just be, as I said, that it's kept from him. Even his advisors may not know where the information is. You know, they get their advice from further advisors, you know, and eventually the buck stops with someone. But, you know, it's like, who knows who's sitting on the secret and, you know, when the lie or the distortion begins. You know, it may be three advisors down the line, not just, you know, oh, yeah, let's deceive the president, you know, and it's all being done in the White House. You know, it could be three agencies or three people down the line who are feeding the fake stories or whatever.
You know, thinking about this same subject, I was thinking the other day, it could be that some of this stuff is so buried and so secret and so few know about it or in the loop. There could be many, many projects out there that have been long forgotten, and perhaps every player is no longer with us, you know. Boxes like Indiana Jones, where there's some sort of artifact with a report, but nobody even remembers it's there because all the people who recovered it and worked on this secret project kept it so secret, and they're all dead. Nobody knows it's there.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, on that same line, an important thing is that, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, coming back to Roswell, that the government has probably, you know, even if the government wasn't responsible for creating, like, the Mogul and the crash test dummy stories as cover stories, I'm pretty sure that whoever's in the know is happy that those stories are out there. You know, and I'm sure they've encouraged a lot of confusion over the subject over the years. But the interesting thing is that when you start spreading confusion and cover stories, in the military, after 20, 30 years, 40 years, those guys who've long retired and said, well, I read a file, you know, that said a Mogul balloon came down at Roswell, not realizing that was a faked document, you know, to sort of confuse the issue even more. In other words, 30 years down the line, it's not just that everybody's died. It's like with conflicting stories, even the government doesn't know what it knows and doesn't know
right.
which documents are true or which documents were put out as like a psychological warfare cover story. And somebody may legitimately go to their grave believing that because they saw a file saying crash test dummies came down at Roswell, that that's what the bodies were, not realizing maybe that, you know, somebody was purposefully encouraging, maybe even encouraging the Air Force to go with that angle, you know.
Right.
That
so everybody's lied so much, including to each other and themselves, that nobody knows the truth anymore.
Yeah, that may be. That there could just be like a small, you know, 30, 40 people who, I mean, the biggest irony could be that if aliens did crash at Roswell, there could just be like some underground vault with, you know, the remains of a crashed UFO, 6 or 7 bodies in frozen storage, and the government and the people in the know thinking, well, we've got this material, what the hell do we do with it? You know, they just go in and look at it once a day, make sure it's still there. You know,
right.
They can't tell anybody about it. It's so advanced,
yeah.
They can't even back engineer it. All they know is that they pick something up 64 years ago that isn't human, and it's a huge albatross around the necks because they don't know what to do with it. So they just bury it and just look at it through the door panel once a day, like, wow, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Which
that wouldn't surprise me if that wasn't the truth of the scenarios.
It's cynical, and it's kind of a 1980 view of things or something, this over-bureaucracy, but I think that's entirely possible. I totally agree with that. I did want to ask you about also, because of your view of extraterrestrials and your open-mindedness about the various different possibilities out there, but also your interest in contactees, which I think is great because there's a lot of the history or the mythology of this field that is getting forgotten, and this is one that the media never picked up on, and unless, you know, some of us talk about it who are aware of it, it's going to get forgotten. And that's a whole contactee era of the 50s, which was huge. Thousands of people meeting in the desert in California to see these contactees talk. And all of these people had, in some cases, some fairly credible cases of talking with extraterrestrials. What do you think about the contactees in that era?
Oh, well, I'm very interested in the whole contactee movement. In fact, I wrote a book in 2009 with the stunningly original title of Contactees.
Nobody had it yet.
Yeah, you know, just so people would know what it was called. Yeah, I thought I'll dumb it down or whatever. So. But I mean, the contactee movement, you know, it gets a really bad rap today. You know, everybody's cool with abductions and little grey guys with black eyes and huge heads and, you know, stealing DNA and eggs and sperm, etc., and missing time, because that sounds more credible and scientific, which, you know, it does. A lot of people within ufology are almost kind of embarrassed to deal with the sort of, you know, the long-haired space hippie, space brother type characters of the 1950s. You know, the typical scenario for people listening who, you know, might not be fully conversant with the early years of ufology, you know, contactees were people who claimed, chiefly sort of kicked off in the early 50s, although there are a lot of parallels with you know, ancient reports and latter-day stories, but kicked off chiefly in the early 50s where a lot of people, particularly across the US, but also across the world, claimed face-to-face contact with very human-looking aliens, often described as slightly shorter than us, or sometimes taller than us, but very often with like heads of long blonde hair. This is for the men as well, you know, which wasn't certainly sort of par for the course, you know, in sort of 1950s America. You know, you'd definitely look twice if you saw a guy with his like long blonde hair halfway down his back, you know what I mean? And, you know, a lot of them had no previous interest in UFOs, but felt compelled, for whatever reason, you know, to go out to like remote desert locations in, say, Nevada or the California desert and just wait, not knowing why. You know, and then they'd say this sort of gleaming flying saucer would come down, these human, almost like early flower power equivalent aliens would come out of these craft, and, you know, there'd be this sort of philosophical exchange all about nuclear war and how we need to disarm our atomic weapons and live in peace and harmony. You know, it very much was like an early sort of equivalent of, you know, sort of the peace movement that came with the, you know, Vietnam War protests in the 60s. But it was, you know, the message was supposedly coming from aliens. Now, for the most part, researchers of the contactee movement sort of place it into two camps. You know, you've got the people who say, you know, this is just total nonsense, you know, the idea of aliens coming from wherever, looking just like us, talking like us, dressing in like pilots' flight suits, long blonde hair, telling us to disarm our nukes and turning up in the, you know, New Mexico desert or the desert of California and just chatting with people. And then on the other hand, you have people who interpret the stories literally. But I kind of take a different view, the idea that the experiences, I believe, were genuine. And I believe they were genuine experiences with some sort of alien phenomenon, alien in the sense of non-human, whether alien in the terms of extraterrestrial or something else, you know, interdimensional, whatever, I don't know, but certainly non-human. What I think and what I sort of discussed chiefly in my contactees book was the idea that we're dealing with an intelligence that has the ability to interact with the human mind and kind of get into our subconscious. And what it does, it kind of manifests in a fashion that's acceptable and applicable to the people of the time. So in other words, it's almost like what I believe has happened is that the person has gone out, you know, say 1954, they go out to the California desert. They have this experience, which is very much like a shamanic experience, you know, thousands of years ago, going up to the mountain and communing with the gods, you know, or angels. But today it's like long-haired, angelic-looking aliens. And there's this sort of philosophical exchange about how we need to live our lives, which, you know, this gets into controversial territory, but it's not much different to Moses going up Mount Sinai and receiving the Ten Commandments, which happen to tell you how to live your life, you know. There's not much difference.
Right.
And I think this phenomena has the ability to sort of pull imagery from our subconscious and appear for us in a fashion that is acceptable to us. So I think, in other words, I don't believe the contactees had literal face-to-face encounters with long-haired aliens coming from nuts and bolts spacecraft, but that was the pop culture imagery through Hollywood movies like Day the Earth Stood Still and Invaders from Mars and all these sorts of films that existed at the time. People were aware of that imagery in the same way that today people are aware of like the grey, black-eyed alien imagery. And I think certain encounters today that fall into that category are due to the mind being manipulated. I think this phenomenon, whatever it is, wants to interact with us, wants to teach us, wants to tell us things, but I'm not sure we've ever seen it in its real, original, raw form. I think we're seeing some, like almost like a hologram or something, an imagery instilled in our minds that we're comfortable with. And I think, you know, when you find out that some of the contactees, for example, you know, they contacted the Space Brothers not by going out into the desert, but by ESP or, I mean, one George Van Tassel, he said his contact was initially made by what he called thought transfers or what we call ESP.
Mm-hmm.
George Hunt Williamson made his initial contacts by Ouija boards. Others did go out into the desert. Others felt that they fell asleep and then entered like a trance-like state where these entities then entered the person's dream state, as if they literally invaded the person's dreams. And I think what this tells me is that many of the contactees had experiences with something, but it's clear when you read their accounts, they were having these experiences in altered states. And I
mm-hmm.
think that's an important thing. That's why I believe their stories are real, but I don't take them literally black and white as encounters with, you know, Commander Zargov from Venus. You know, that was the pop culture imagery that they were ripping from people's minds and manifesting in that form. And I think the contactee movement is a fascinating one because I really do believe it demonstrates, for me at least, undeniable contact with something when we get past the sort of camouflage imagery they use to interact with us. Then we kind of see beyond the veil, if you like, beyond the curtain as to who or whatever this phenomenon really is.
Right. And that's why I love it, because it is I think, you know, it's so enigmatic that it's hard to put kind of figure it out. These people seem to have these experiences. At one hand, they're being told these extremely wise things that we really need to hear as a culture or as individuals. On the other hand, you're being told these crazy things that, you know, many would disregard as certainly not true, such as, you know, maybe coming from the moon and the other side of the moon has gardens and is beautiful. And so because one side is definitely not true, the whole the baby's thrown out with the bathwater and the whole phenomena is disregarded. But I agree with you. It is something important that shouldn't be forgotten.
Yeah, and I think you just hit on a very important point there, that the issue of how it's, you know, it's this or that, is black or it's white, you know, no pun intended, it's often grey. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of like...
We've heard that
that's why I said,
on the show.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's kind of like with the contact teas. I said they get a bad rap because, you know, on the one hand, you have the people who interpret all literally and they're laughed at, saying, you know, oh, yeah, these aliens come from Venus. On the other hand, you know, you have a lot of academic people and scientific people who, if they'd look beyond the just the front window image, if you like, and just say, no, this is nonsense, there's no life on Venus, but then looked further into these accounts and see how people were clearly rendered into altered states or their perception was being manipulated, I think we can actually learn a great deal from the contactees. And in many cases, studying their cases could be the key to actually understanding a great deal about the nature of the intelligence behind the phenomenon. Possibly even, you know, we could learn far more from them than we could from today's abductees. But it's kind of like a taboo area that, oh, it's that, just that ridiculous crap from the 50s, you know, and whatever.
Right. You know what? There's so much to say about this topic, and I love this topic, and I think it would hit on something really important. I think it'd be fun to talk about that. I want to have you on again in the future, hopefully not too far, and we'll hit this topic in particular and move on to the contactees of today because it's so interesting. But right now we're out of time.
We've got missing time almost.
Yeah, I think so. There's always missing time, you know, when we get interested. It feels like, you know, 2 minutes have passed by, not a whole hour. But thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really interesting. And where's the best place for people to go find information and read your books?
People can find out more and also contact me at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com.
Okay, nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. Blogspot.
Yep. Blogspot.
All right. And they could Google you and you'll find all kinds of stuff, including cool pictures of you doing your different rock and roll poses. All right, thank you so much for being on the show, like I said before, and you know, we'll talk soon. It's been a really interesting show.
Well, thanks, Andrew, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we are out of time, everybody. Like Nick said, you know, go Google him, Nick Redfern's books. blogspot.com. I think I got that right. So check him out and buy his books because they're very interesting. And I really think, you know, this open-mindedness and this being open to all the different aspects, but also not, you know, hiding anything is so important because this phenomena tells us a lot about ourselves and, you know, those consciousnesses that are external to us. So it's a lot of fun to talk about this stuff. We are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us at Open Minds TV. Don't forget to visit openminds.tv for the latest news. And again, like I said, you know, go visit my Huffington Post blogs that I'll keep posting, and also ufodailynews.com for more UFO news. And that's where I post my Huffington Post stories when I'm done with them. And I'm tweeting UFO news on a regular basis. So you have a tweet news line to get the latest UFO news. Join us next week when we're going to have another exciting guest. I don't have it completely confirmed right now, so I won't tell you the name, but I'll tell you it's going to be great. So we'll talk to you soon, everybody. Have a great week. Go close music. Absolutely.